Support for Modern Love comes from Living Proof. How long can you...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Go between washes. Keep your hair cleaner longer while washing less for beautiful, healthier hair. Use the code LOVE at livingproof.com for a free travel size dry shampoo with your $20 order. We are the science. You are the living proof. And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will deliver seasonal recipes with pre-measured ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals for less than $10 each. Get three meals free with free shipping at blueapron.com/modern. That's /modern. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Caitlin Dewey was a senior in college when she thought she'd met the man of her dreams. And then she decided to spend time with him in person. That's when it got complicated. Issa Rae, star of the new HBO comedy Insecure, reads Caitlin's essay, "Even in Real Life, There Were Screens Between Us."
Curled up at the foot of my bed, my face inches from the laptop screen, I stared anxiously at the Google chat box. "Will is typing," the box told me, helpfully. I forced myself to read email while I waited for his message. Then I refreshed my Twitter feed, scrolled through my blog posts, and began brushing my teeth. Still, the box said, "Will is typing." "Don't you dare get hurt by this," I muttered around my toothpaste. "This was a stupid idea, and you knew that from the start." But recognizing the stupidity of falling for someone on the internet does not prevent you from doing it. My friend Jeanette, a college radio DJ, chats constantly with some music blogger she met on Tumblr. My friend Tawan, who lives in Los Angeles, stays up until after 3 to talk to his London-based girlfriend. And I had just driven nearly 1,100 miles round trip to visit Will, a guy I met in October at a web journalism conference and got to know almost entirely on Skype. I noticed him across the table at a noisy hotel bar. Will owns thick black frame glasses, but no hairbrush or comb, traits that lend him the look of a basement-bound hacker. If you have ever attended an internet conference, you understand how pale skin, thick glasses, and scruffy hair can be attractive. Otherwise, I can't explain it to you. In either case, I liked Will's weirdly overconfident smirk and his obsession with WordPress. He regaled me with the merits of plugins and PHP until I became tired and went to bed. "I'll find you on Twitter," I joked when I left. I didn't expect or even want to see Will again after that weekend. Since he lived 3 states away, further FaceTime seemed unlikely. I followed his Twitter posts with detached curiosity. In January, he G-chatted me to complain about work. Then he got drunk and messaged me again sometime near midnight as I uploaded photos and otherwise wasted bandwidth. With obvious sarcasm, he wrote, "Do you have that Skype thing kids talk about these days?" I've read that 90% of human communication is nonverbal. Skype captures that 90% on a low-resolution video camera, compresses it, funnels it to a node computer, and reproduces it on a screen anywhere in the world. Skype eliminates distance. That's why it works. And that's exactly what it did for us. With my Skype screen open and my webcam on, I viscerally felt that Will was sitting a foot away on my bed. Ignoring the times the picture froze or his voice cut out, I thought he looked and sounded exactly like he did in person. Sometimes, when he leaned into the computer to read an article I'd sent him, I could see the pores on his face. We started video chatting for hours every night. He from an ascetic all-white bedroom, me from the cupcake print corner of my studio apartment. I learned that he ate takeout for every meal and slept in a series of identical white V-neck t-shirts and smirked with one side of his mouth when I said something clever. I knew his preferred coding languages, his least favorite content management system, and his general hatred of dancing, small talk, and girls in bars. One night, when we talked too late, I fell asleep with my laptop open and woke up 7 hours later, tangled in cords. And he was still there, asleep in the light from an open window, pale and young and pixelated. Eventually, he stirred, blinked at the camera, and said, "Hey, you." "Hey," I said easily. "How did you sleep?" As the weeks went on, I told Will about my last boyfriend, a guy I had met in psychology class and dated for almost 2 years. He listened quietly, his glasses reflecting my image from his computer, and gave good, clear-eyed advice about letting go. I couldn't remember the last time I met somebody that smart and talented in ways I certainly wasn't. He told me about his ex-girlfriend who never appreciated his work. And I texted him from classes when I was frustrated or bored. In the safety of my apartment, I could see Will, but I couldn't touch him. I could summon him when I wanted to talk, but I never knew him in any light other than the one from his bedside lamp. This phenomenon worked in my favor as well. You know, I could call him after a few drinks when I felt sufficiently talkative and social. I could avoid him if I had videos to edit or blog posts to write. I could say whatever I wanted and risk awkwardness because at the end of the conversation, one click of the mouse would shut him out of my room. The irony is that we flock to the internet for this type of safe, sanitized intimacy, but we want something entirely different. In real life, or IRL, is a popular term in online parlance. At internet conferences like the one where I met Will, Twitter explodes with people celebrating IRL meetings. "Oh, so nice to finally see at so-and-so IRL. Hey, at so-and-so, I can't believe we hadn't met IRL yet." The internet brings these people together with hashtags and message boards, but it never satisfies them. No matter how much you love someone's blog or Twitter feed, it isn't their posts you actually want. And so, slowly, cautiously, Will and I began circling the question of what it all meant. "I really like you," he said one night after getting home from the bar. "I really like you too," I said. "I don't know what that means." I wanted to find out. So, in early March, I rented a car, begged my professors to let me out of class a day early, and drove 540 miles to spend a long weekend in the mid-sized city where Will lives. When I got close, I called my friend Tuan from a rest stop, where I fixed my makeup and chewed gum and generally tried to calm down. "What if it's terrible?" I demanded. "What if he's nothing like I expect?" In fact, Will was almost exactly as I expected. Thin lips, straight nose, small hazel eyes, glasses. He stood waiting at the side of the street while I parked my car, going forward and back, until I nervously got within 2 feet of the curb. We kissed on the cold, blustery sidewalk as the wind whipped my thoughts around. Mostly, I felt relieved. I thought, this works in real life. This means something. But after we kissed and ate pizza and went back to his house, we struggled for things to talk about. In real life, Will stared off at nothing while we talked. In real life, he had no questions about the drive or my work or the stuff that waited for me when I went back to school. He took me out for dinner and read his email while we waited for our food. He apologized profusely, but still checked his website's traffic stats while we sat in his living room. He took me to a party at his friend's house where they proceeded to argue for hours about web design while I sat on a futon and stared at the ceiling, drunk and bored and terribly concerned that I looked thinner online. At points, he grabbed my hand and gave me small, apologetic smiles. It seemed like a strategy game, a constant dance of reaching for me and pulling back, of intimacy and distance, of real life and internet make-believe. On the last day of my visit, Will overslept. He rushed around the apartment with his hair wet and his tie untied, looking for his laptop. According to the plan we made the night before, he would go to work and I would leave when it suited me, dropping his spare keys in the mailbox. In the front hallway, where I stood rubbing my eyes, Will hugged me goodbye and told me to drive safely. He struggled for a closing statement. "It was great to see you," he said at last. I didn't leave right away. After I showered and packed and studied the books near his fireplace, I sat for a long time at his kitchen counter, trying to work out what happened. I didn't like being surrounded by his things. I felt more comfortable in my room with my things and with his presence confined to a laptop screen. I wrote him a note before I left. "Dear Will, thank you so much for having me this weekend. It meant a lot to me to spend time with you in person." I signed my name and left it on the counter. Then, willing myself not to cry, I dropped his keys in the mailbox and gunned it home. In real life, getting there took 9 hours.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with The New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building, find an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to The New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Issa Rae, reading Caitlin Dewey's essay, "Even in Real Life, There Were Screens Between Us." So did Caitlin ever meet someone? More in a minute.
Living Proof products make life easier. Just ask Sarah from Los Angeles.
Recently, I had to have surgery, and as a result, it was very hard for me to raise my arm and wash my hair. That's when I relied on the dry shampoo. Being able to at least have clean hair just really helped me stay sane. That Perfect Hair Day dry shampoo was huge for me.
Use the code LOVE for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order. Livingproof.com.
I'm Steve Allman.
I'm Cheryl Strayed. And we're the co-hosts of Dear Sugar Radio, a podcast from WBUR for the lost, lonely, and heartsick.
We take your questions, no matter how deep and dark, and offer radically empathic advice.
Subscribe to Dear Sugar Radio on iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Caitlin Dewey's essay was published in 2011. She was a senior in college, and it was hard to imagine that millions of people may be reading her work. Was Will one of them?
We actually had a very classic internet miscommunication, which is very fitting when you think about it. I had G-chatted him before the essay came out, but, you know, once I had been notified that it was going to be published. And I said, you know, hey, I just want to give you a heads up. I wrote this essay. It's going to be published in the New York Times. And apparently I actually made a typo and I said the New U Times, U-Y-O-U. And he read it and was like, you know, what is that? Some like holistic web magazine or something. So he was just kind of like, you know, good for you. Like, hope you're well. Bye. So, you know, a couple months after that, the essay actually came out. My understanding is that he was at brunch with a group of friends, one of whom was reading the Times and recognized him in my essay and then proceeded to do a dramatic reading for the entire table. So I guess I had my vengeance in the end.
In case you were wondering, Will was actually quite gracious about the whole thing, but Caitlin still had those millions of people to worry about.
In 2011, obviously, online dating sites existed, but I think the phenomenon of meeting someone and starting a relationship purely on the internet was still a little more foreign, maybe a little more stigmatized. So I was anxious that I would get a lot of negative responses. I don't think there were actually any negative responses at all. I heard from a lot of people who had gone through similar things or things that ended better than mine had, which was wonderful. I heard from a gentleman in prison who was serving a life sentence for murder, who told me that the essay had really captured his feelings of what it was like to relate as a person in prison to people on the outside, which I thought was a sort of fascinating parallel. So yeah, the reaction was very gratifying.
So what happened to her love life after this essay was published?
In the most awkward way possible, I would usually try to sort of proactively mention the essay in a really cool, casual way on the first date. So, you know, we would have had like a coffee or like a drink or something. And we'd be talking about like what we did for a living. And I'd be like, oh, yeah, by the way, you know, I write about such and such now, but I did have an essay published in the New York Times. No big deal. Like, if you happen to see it, don't worry about it. And, you know, no surprise there, but none of those dates really went anywhere.
But there's even more news.
In less than a year, I'm getting married, and I met my fiancé. His name is Jason. We actually met on OkCupid, which is ironic in hindsight, you know, given everything. But we met about a year after the essay came out, and we've been dating for almost 5 years, and we're getting married next September.
Caitlin continues to write, now for The Washington Post. She's a digital culture critic and spends a lot of time thinking about the internet. But her views about our collective digital future have shifted.
Even at the time I wrote the essay.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
I was still extremely optimistic about the potential for, you know, digital technology to sort of enhance our relationships. I would say I've become markedly more cynical in the 5 years since then. I find myself wondering if it enhances our relationships and our ability to connect with one another, or if it actually sort of distracts from them, if we're not thoughtful enough about the way that we connect with people through these technologies and the way that they're sort of impacting our lives and our thought processes and our relationships.
But some of those internet connections can't be shaken.
I'm actually still in touch with some of his friends who reached out to me after the essay was published, people I had met when I went up there to visit them. And, you know, they said they loved the essay. They were really nice about it. But they said they were sorry that I hadn't had fun at their party and they hadn't realized it at the time.
Caitlin Dewey, writer of this week's essay. You can read more of her writing in The Washington Post. We'll link to her column on our website, wbur.org/modernlove. We'll hear from Modern Love editor Daniel Jones and actor Issa Rae after the break.
Not all ingredients are created equal. Blue Apron sources fresh, high-quality ingredients and sends them right to your home in pre-measured packages. You get easy-to-follow recipes, so you can have a meal ready in 40 minutes or less. There's no weekly commitment, so you only get deliveries when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free, with free shipping, by going to blueapron.com/modern. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/modern. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Caitlin Dewey's essay was selected as part of the Modern Love College Essay Contest. It happens every 3 years. Here's Daniel Jones, Modern Love editor for The New York Times.
The winner of that contest each time has written the best essay about the most common topic that students were obsessing about that year. And Caitlin's piece is this sort of perfect distillation of the highs and lows of the online romance. And that's what so many students wrote about that year. This was back in 2011. And I had expected for this contest, the previous contest was 3 years before, the popular theme that year was all about shallow physical relationships and hooking up and the consequences of that and the benefits of that and people struggling with it one way or another. And I didn't think that that much would change in 3 years, but not only were the themes different, they'd swung pretty much 180 degrees in the other direction. So instead of shallow physical relationships, people were writing about deep online relationships, nothing physical about them, total emotional connections that fell apart when they became in-person relationships. And so when you're used to getting your emotional fix through the screen and suddenly that person is with you, you're still going to be distracted by the screen. You know, they go out to a meal and he's on his phone. They go back to the apartment and he's on his laptop. That's where that emotional fix had been getting met, and that habit is just too ingrained.
Dan Jones, editor of Modern Love for The New York Times. Issa Rae, the reader of this week's essay, really connected with Caitlin's story. Before HBO's Insecure, she created the popular web series The Misadventures of Awkward Black Girl, garnering over 25 million views.
It really resonated with me. I've fallen in love online before. I have met people from online that I've been friends with, that I've wanted relationships with, and it's gone awry. There is something about, you know, talking online that's way more magical than it is in person. It's on your terms when it's online, and in person you're just way more vulnerable in a way that's kind of unsettling. I was just drawn to that. I felt for this girl and wanted her to, you always want it to work out, but in this case it didn't, and I got her.
Many thanks to Issa Rae. Her new comedy is Insecure. See it Sunday nights on HBO. And we'll link to the trailer at wbur.org/modernlove. Next week, Ruth Naga, star of the new movie Loving. She tells the story of a woman and her tortoise.
One weekend, when he had gone out to spend the bright summer day with his parents at their country club, I was sitting alone watching an old movie on TV, the tortoise in my lap, a book on the table for later. As I stroked Minnie's leathery head, I began to realize how calm and happy I was. I had a more fulfilling relationship with the tortoise than I did with the boyfriend.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Our casting consultant is Amy Lippins, CSA. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.